Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I guess one end of the spectrum, reading this book made me feel like these guys were potentially almost indigenous people, like the last of the indigenous people living off the land in the UK, you know, whether you agree with it or not.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and episode 49 with Emma Crome. Emma is one of my closest friends, and she's one of the director team at our film production company, Cold House. Emma and I have known each other for a long time now, and a few years ago, she began work on a film project about the state of nature in the UK. In the middle of the COVID-19 lockdown, we sat down to record this podcast, focusing on Emma's upbringing, her views on British wilderness, and her hunt for Brian Tovey, the last English poacher. Emma has decided to release Brian's story as a short film, which, all being well, will be released in spring 2021. I'm hopeful that one day, once the film has been released, that we'll have the chance to bring Brian onto the podcast. But in the meantime, we've cut a few short sections from Emma's interviews with Brian into the conversation. Emma has also kindly written a list of books that work well as a starter kit for wrapping your head around Britain's natural landscape and its heritage, which we'll share on our Instagram account at The Adventure Podcast and in the show notes on theadventurepodcast.co.uk. Okay, we'll dive straight into the conversation with Emma Crome.
In my head, I'm just like, I don't really get it, considering all of the people that you've already interviewed. I'm not George Monbiot, I'm not Aldo Kane, I'm not swinging through the jungle, you know, on ropes like Waldo Etherington. I'd love to be, but I've had my fair share of adventures, but not on the same scale. I'm not sure I want them on the same scale as some of the expeditions that I hear about or read about. I quite like the quirky little adventures where people say, "You did what? Why did you do that?" Whereas when it's climbing a mountain or exploring the jungle, people can understand it. But when it's driving 200 miles to go and find a man that illegally hunts game in the UK, I don't know, I think that's probably a bit more random, but to me that's an adventure. I read a book, I think I told you about a guy, Thomas Furbank, back in the 50s, got an old fixer-upper down in Devon, close to where my parents live, and I read this book and it was incredible, just a story about subsistence living. You know, this guy that fell in love with this property and did it up and lived off the land on the fringes of Dartmoor. And I was so fascinated. And again, in this book, it wasn't mentioned where this house was exactly. It just gave very sort of vague descriptions of the surrounding landscape and landmarks. And I got so obsessed that I went to find the house. I just wanted to see it for myself and to, you know, just be able to place it, I suppose. Because it's in a place where I grew up and I used to go walking, and it just fascinated me. And there was a sketch in the front of the book, like a map of the surrounding area. And I used that and I compared it with an ordnance survey map. And it eventually found it. It took me a day of driving around the country lanes. But I found it and I just kind of peered over the gate. I was like, I'm sure this is it. And then someone came out of the front door, this lady, and I thought, shall I? It's like, yeah, why not? So I just went through the gate and walked up the drive and introduced myself and said, oh, I read this book by Thomas Fairbank called Log Hut, and I'm pretty sure this is the place. I was just interested, and this lady just laughed and said, yep, you're in the right place, this is his house. And she invited me in and we had a cup of tea and she showed me around, and she bought the property without knowing like the story of Thomas Fairbank. He'd written like 3 or 4 books, but she didn't know anything about it until she bought the property and then realised the historical connection. And then she'd become as fascinated with his life and the book, and she like collected them all and had loads of limited edition copies of the book. And so we just had this chat and she showed me around the whole of the grounds and the house, and it just, I don't know, felt like being a little part of history or proper just research, but not for any other reason than my own curiosity, I suppose. And that's what adventure is to me.
I think our own curiosity is a pretty good reason to have an adventure.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's maybe the only reason, isn't it?
Yeah.
But so I do that kind of random stuff all the time.
Yeah.
If you don't reach out to people, if you don't ask, if you don't explore these opportunities, then you just never know what you're missing out on. I suppose it's a bit like in 1999, I wrote a letter to Richard Curtis about how much I loved The Vicar of Dibley. And I don't quite know how it happened, but he wrote back and invited me to spend a day on the set. I wish I'd kept the letter that I'd written, because obviously whatever I said was obviously very complimentary and nice, and I got to go and with my family, and we spent a whole day on the set watching the filming, and it was just a pretty magical day, you know, once-in-a-lifetime sort of opportunity. It was a bit jammy. Like my family always say, oh, you're such a jammy git, all these things you do, but it's only because I've put myself forward for the opportunity, I suppose. I'd kind of speak to the right people and ask the right questions, and yeah.
I was about to ask if you've always been curious, but I suppose you answered that with your Richard Curtis story. So I guess, you know, it leads us really nicely into, when did you first hear about Brian Tovey, and why did he kind of pique your interest?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to think how best to place the start, or where to place the start of a very long story.
Well, you can tell us the story of Albion.
Yeah, so I suppose to put things in context, I grew up in South Devon, close to Dartmoor, and I had quite a sort of outdoor upbringing. I mean, I lived in, you know, classic suburbia, but was always a bit of a tomboy. My best friend Sam, he lived on the edge of Dartmoor, and in our school holidays we used to run a bit feral on the moors. I used to go and stay with him, and we would build dens in the woods, we would climb trees, we'd make ridiculous tree swings, we would nick his old brother's tree surgery ropes, and we would go and set up abseils off the top of Hator Rocks before I even knew what rock climbing was, using an old figure of eight plate, and we'd just go and rig a rope and abseil off the back of Hator. And we used to sneak out of his house in the middle of the night, so we'd wait till his parents and his brothers had gone to bed, and we used to climb out of the window and then just sneak off up onto the moors and make a little campfire and just stay out for the night, just, you know, getting up to all sorts of like mischief and And then we would get back at about 5 o'clock in the morning before everyone was getting up to go to work, and sneak back into the house and get into bed and, like, you know, have a little snooze until, you know, mid-morning or whatever. And no one was any the wiser. And those sorts of experiences were just, you know, that was my, when I look back, that was my childhood. You know, getting a bit sort of scruffy, climbing trees, building dens. We used to play a game called Olympic Gardens, and this involved plotting a little route through the neighbouring houses in the little hamlet where Sam lived. And we would, again, this sort of waiting until it got quite dark, and we would sneak out of the house and we would challenge each other to kind of sneak through these little routes through people's back gardens, linking up people's back gardens and private property. So we'd run around, we would get into someone's back garden, and we'd challenge each other to try and sneak past the kitchen window, and you'd see someone inside doing the washing up or whatever, and you'd have to, like, crawl underneath the window, or you'd, like, run past the French windows, the patio doors at the back of the house, basically just try to not get caught, occasionally do the whole, you know, knock on the door and run away, that kind of thing. But we called it Olympic Gardens, and it was like the same route that just kind of got ever more challenging. And it was all innocent fun, you know. I think we probably still did it into like our early teens when we suddenly realised that actually maybe we're a bit old to be doing it now. And, you know, if someone did actually catch us in the back garden, then it was, we'd probably get into more trouble than when we were kind of a lot younger. But yeah, those sorts of experiences just shaped my outlook on life and adventure, and I guess perhaps not wanting to conform to societal norms. And it was just really good fun as well. And then I kind of, as I got older, I got into climbing and hiking and wild camping. And I was very familiar, obviously, with Dartmoor. Spent all my holidays in Snowdonia or the Lake District. And so I really kind of revered our countryside, loved the outdoors. I suppose looking back, felt like I knew everything there is to know about, you know, our kind of rural areas. And then I stumbled across a TED talk from George Monbiot, which was called How Wolves Change Rivers. And this explained how the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone National Park had ultimately transformed the landscape. And by reintroducing wolves, which was the missing apex predator to the ecosystem, it changed the behaviour of the deer in the park, who started avoiding kind of open spaces. Therefore, those open spaces started regenerating with plants and trees. Therefore, that brought birds back and insects, and just the knock-on, the cascade effect down the ecosystem meant that in the end, because plants started growing, it stabilised the ground, which meant the rivers started changing course, and it was just this whole, it's called a trophic cascade, fascinating, I'd never heard about it. And then this led me into the whole subject of rewilding. I watched that TED talk, listened to the TED talk, and that blew my mind. And then by chance I stumbled across another talk that George had done on specifically on rewilding, and it revealed to me the reality of our situation in the UK, which is that our countryside, our land, is hugely impoverished. We're quite species poor through various reasons, intensive agriculture, you know, deforestation, you know, development. Actually, we don't have a wilderness in the UK. You know, there is no wilderness left. And rewilding is actually like a positive way of trying to regenerate the land to what it once was. But, you know, I didn't really know all this. I just always revered our countryside and loved wild camping, even though it's not wild. And so it just totally altered my perspective. It was a revelation You know, I'd never been interested in conservation or ecology or anything like that, you know. And so I suppose rewilding captured my imagination and also shocked me into thinking, Christ, the UK is, you know, an ecological disaster zone, for want of a better word. And then I thought, well, why aren't more people talking about this? You know, why is there not more stuff in the news about, you know, how bad intensive agriculture is, and, you know, why aren't more people discussing the environmental problems on our own doorstep, as well as what's going on elsewhere in the world? And that's when I came to the realisation that I wanted to make a documentary film about this. And that was 4 years ago. And it's been quite a journey. I want to tell the human story around our perception of wilderness in the UK in 21st century Britain. And I wanted to try and like reach outside of the echo chamber. And I also want to tell the human stories of, you know, our rural history and how we've impacted the land. I think there are lots of people out there who are doing a very good job of creating wonderful wildlife documentaries, but there's kind of less around the human stories. And this would also help to kind of create empathy and interest from, a wider audience potentially. So my research into making this documentary involved trying to find different characters to kind of represent the ideas and themes. And along the way, I've met and interviewed people like George Monbiot, Peter Taylor, who's a scientist, he's a conservationist and a shaman, Waldo Etherington, who you've had on the podcast, who's a professional tree climber, and various other people, all with differing interests in the environment and conservation in the UK. And then, I suppose 3 or 4 years ago, I read a book called The Last English Poachers, which is about a father and son based down in the southwest. And they essentially live a subsistence life, live off the land by taking game, like deer and rabbits and pheasants, from private estates and farmland that surround their village.
Everything I get, I eat. And I'm nature, you're nature, we're all nature. I like to hunt for food, same as a fox hunts for food.
And the story struck a chord with me. I never really knew anything about poaching, apart from what you hear, obviously, things that are happening in, you know, Africa and India. What people imagine when you talk about poaching is, you know, rhino horns being cut off and, you know, endangered species. And so to kind of learn more about the history of poaching in the UK was fascinating. And I guess one end of the spectrum, reading this book made me feel like these guys were potentially almost indigenous people, like the last of the indigenous people living off the land in the UK, you know, whether you agree with it or not. And then the other end of the spectrum is that they are just, you know, common criminals causing trouble and, yeah, you know, carrying out illegal activity. And I just thought, well, these guys would be amazing to go and interview.
Why?
So they live off the land, essentially. And the way that they live off the land, you know, it's not like any kind of farming or conservation or, you know, like having an allotment. They are, their knowledge of the land and wildlife, you know, what they don't know about wildlife isn't worth knowing. So putting aside the sort of illegal element of their activity, they hunt animals for food, yes, but to do that, they understand the animal's behaviour, they know how to track the animals, they know how to do it in a sustainable way, and they also love it. You know, it's just their whole life. Their life is rooted in the countryside and their life is rooted in one place, in one area. You know, they've lived there, that, you know, the family's lived there for generations and they know every inch of the lands, the surrounding woodland, the rivers, the fields. They just know it all. And so that kind of depth of connection, to me, just was quite unusual. You know, you don't really get that in 21st century Britain. Lots of people will go out for a walk with their dog in the park or visit a national park or a particular beauty spot, but their time there is limited. And then they go home to, you know, go to work, whatever their distractions are. You know, it's they're not living and breathing it like these guys are.
It's changed. People are in supermarkets now, don't they? People do their shopping online and they go to towns now where it's a quarter of the price. And most people here now wouldn't know what poaching is.
In the context of Britain and Brian's story, what is poaching?
In the context of Britain, poaching actually comes from the 11th century and the reign of William the Conqueror. He introduced something called forest law to Britain, which was outside of the existing common law at the time. And it essentially reserved hunting rights for the aristocracy on huge areas of land in Britain. So that therefore meant that it actually became illegal for commoners to go onto the land and take game like rabbits, deer, even fish. And therefore, poaching was born out of commoners, you know, the poorer communities and individuals trespassing on these bits of private land to take food for themselves and to feed their families. So in a way, poaching was, I suppose, born out of necessity. You know, people who needed food and sustenance and lived on the fringes of these areas of land, which had become, you know, a privileged area of hunting for the aristocracy, the, you know, commoners would go onto the land and take game for themselves. And, you know, poaching actually comes from, the word poaching comes from the Middle English word pocken, meaning to bag or bag up. And, you know, that's what they used to do. They'd go onto the land in, you know, under cover of darkness and take some game and chuck it in a bag and leg it back to the village and the house, and, you know, so no one could catch them. And, you know, it was punishable by death, you know, till relatively recently, actually, you know, into the 1800s, I suppose, poaching was it's a crime, and you'd get into a lot of trouble if you were caught taking game from estates that were belonged to lords and dukes and earls.
And now?
Well, I suppose it's almost been like poaching's been compounded throughout the centuries by the way that systems have kind of chipped away at our access to land. So things like the Highland Clearances and the Enclosures Acts and even the Industrial Revolution, where people move away from rural areas to go and work in the cities and towns. You know, all of that's kind of compounded our disconnect to the land. And, you know, these days poaching seems, you know, it's very archaic, something that's kind of consigned to the history books. But actually, you know, all Brian is really doing is what his ancestors did, which he wants to go and take a bit of food off the land to feed himself and to make a bit of money.
Everything I get, I eat. And I'm nature. You're nature. We're all nature. I like to hunt for food, same as a fox hunts for food.
So yeah, I wanted to go and speak to them. I did a lot of sleuthing to try and find out, you know, where they lived, and I contacted the author of the book. I emailed him, I emailed the publisher, I even rang them and left a voicemail to try and get the contact details for these guys. And I just heard nothing back. I waited for sort of a couple of months, sent a couple more emails, and it was just radio silence. And so I was getting a bit impatient, wanted to kind of crack on with the interview and the filming. Time was getting on, so in the end, I decided that I would try and pinpoint the village where they lived, because it wasn't actually mentioned in the book, the actual name of the place. So again, did the whole trying to reference or cross-reference all the different landmarks to try and narrow down the most likely place where they lived. And through a bit of reading, actually discovered that the father had passed away about 4 years ago, but the son was still alive. So it was worth pursuing. So yeah, I was fairly confident that I'd pinpointed the village, and I got into the van, packed up the van, and I drove 200 miles, whatever it was, to go and knock on doors and track down the poacher. And I guess I was a bit nervous. It was, I don't know, maybe it seems like a bit of a crazy thing to try and go and find a man who, and to ask him to be a part of a film which could compromise his way of life, you know, and I might not have had that warmer reception. I just didn't know what to expect, I suppose, but I just felt it was just so worth trying. And again, that whole curiosity, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what the outcome would be. And again, that's, to me, that's like a proper adventure. You know, you don't know who you're going to meet, and you don't know what's going to unfold. And that, to me, is so exciting. It's just the best feeling. And being entirely sort of independent, you know, no one to answer to, you just come up with an idea and you see it through. So I drove down. I rocked up in this village on the high street. It was a pretty dilapidated old village. Actually now sort of a rat run through to the main motorway nearby. And it was about 6 o'clock in the evening, and I pulled up on the high street, and the first thing I saw was a social club. And I thought, well, that seems like a sensible place to start. I was also a bit thirsty. So I went into this social club and got a beer, and I got chatting to a couple of ladies who were sat at the bar, and explained to them who I was looking for, and straight away they knew who I was talking about. But one of the ladies said, oh, you know, I've not really seen him around these parts for a long time. In fact, her brother went to school with him. But she was like, I've just not seen him around here. So I was a bit dejected. Like, God, I've just driven 4 hours or whatever it was, and this isn't a good start. But we got chatting, and then like more locals came in, and I was kind of surrounded by this little village mob who were all really kind of curious as to what I was up to. And one of them actually said to me, you know, be careful, because there, you know, could potentially be an unsavoury character, and just, you know, mind how you go, sort of thing. And that kind of made me feel even more nervous. And I was about to kind of move on when all of a sudden the landlady kind of beckoned me over, and she was like, hey, guess what? Like, Pat over there, she knows the guy. He's his next door, he's a next door neighbour. And I was like, oh my God. And Pat comes over, and she's like super enthusiastic, and she's like, oh yeah, she's like, I've lived next to him for 40 years, I'll take you to see him now. And so this was like quite a sudden change of fortune. It was all quite abrupt, but I just went with it. I was like, right, okay, well, I've come this far, I may as well go along with this. So I followed Pat out of the social club and down this little alleyway, and by now it was sort of, you know, it was dark. All feeling like it's getting a bit sinister, a bit random. And she led me down this little alleyway and just to this little road behind these terrace houses, and through a gate, through a garden, to the back door of this little brick house, and tapped on the window. And yeah, I was a bit like a rabbit in the headlights, I suppose. This guy came to the back door and opened it up, and Pat introduced me to him, and he invited me in. And yeah, I was all of a sudden sat in this strange guy's house. There was taxidermy on the walls. I had this albino hare in a glass case that was like pride of place in this living room. His mum was sat in the corner, like 90 odd year old lady, doing a knitting by the fire. It was all quite sort of calm, and it was almost, the house was, I suppose, felt a bit like stepping back in time, had a bit of a 70s vibe to it. You know, it was very clearly a house that had a lot of history and had been lived in by the same family for years and years. That was like the first impression that I got. And yeah, he sat me down. He was in the middle of having his dinner on a little tray on his lap in the living room. And we got talking, and I told him that I'd read the book and I had been researching for this documentary film and I wanted to interview him. And he was pretty enthusiastic in a very calm way. I mean, nonchalant is the word. He seemed curious, but also at the same time just very accepting. He didn't ask me too many questions, just told me a lot about himself and about his family and his way of life, and it was incredible. And then he agreed almost straight away to the interview, and I explained, you know, that I'd come back with a little crew and we'd do some filming with him, and he was really, really keen. And I was about to sort of wrap things up and head back to the social club where Pat had made me abandon my pint at the bar. and he asked what I was doing for the evening, and I sort of said, well, I'm just in my van, just going to kip here overnight, and I'm going to go home again in the morning. And he was like, well, we can go out poaching if you like. I'll take you out tonight. I was like, oh, all right, okay. This sounds interesting. And I guess I'd secretly been hoping that he would ask me to do that. So yeah, he went off, got me a pair of wellies, and came back, and he like got properly camoed up, big like camo jacket and like a woolly hat on, and like totally looked the part. And yeah, off we went out into the night through the little housing estate and out into the fields, and we spent, must have been 4 or 5 hours, walking through the woods and the dells and through the little streams. And he had this old folding diamond bore shotgun with him. We were just on the cusp of it, like the hunting season being over. So he had to be sort of very careful about, you know, what he was doing, and because he actually, believe it or not, you know, he abides by those seasonal rules of, you know, once it gets into kind of nesting season and breeding season, hunting season stops. He stops, you know. Poaching season for him is obviously hunting season. So yeah, we were kind of right on the cusp of that, and he showed me around all of his haunts, essentially, where, you know, places that I'd read about in the book and places that his father and his grandfather had, you know, poached throughout the decades. It was quite primal in a way. Like wandering through the night, it was quite cold, clear night, not that much foliage on the trees. It was, you know, the sort of end of winter. And it was like following a ghost around the fields almost. Just a very, yeah, very old primal feeling that it gave me. Out there doing something that we weren't supposed to be doing, looking for roosting birds in the trees. He was explaining to me, you know, how you poach and why you do it and what it means to him. Yeah, it was quite otherworldly, I suppose. And it also made me realise that he's the only one doing this. Like, there was no one else out in that area of land. We must have covered about 6 or 7 miles that night, and we didn't come across another soul. Even when we were walking along the bridleways and footpaths, there was no one. And looking back at the lights of the village made me realise how much we have this kind of, we all live in this little bubble now, like a kind of comfort bubble, where we've got, you know, our warm houses, centrally heated, all of the street lights and everything, you know, which are very protective, very defensive. But being out there with him, looking back into the village where everyone's either asleep or, you know, sat watching TV with their takeaway or whatever, it made me realise like how far removed we are from nature.
If you look at this village, 99.9% of people are brought up in what I call a plastic life. Centrally heated houses, brand new clothes, trainers, mollycoddled, and their food source would be burgers, chicken nuggets, supermarkets, all that. They're brought up like that in a plastic life of work, money, debt, that circle. Work, 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 kids go to school at a young age and are brainwashed to continue up, so go into work. No sort of life, not here, not country life now. So they would look upon someone as killing a bird, a rabbit, a deer, for food as unusual and as cruel.
His way of doing things is controversial. You know, he's taking game off private land. But he's doing that to make a living. He's doing it to sort of feed himself. And back in the day when he could sell the game, it was to make some money. So I don't see that there's anything so wrong with that, necessarily. It's almost impossible for people to make a living off the land now unless you're, you know, a farmer. And even then, you're kind of heavily reliant on subsidies a lot of the time. But, you know, here's just a man who clearly loved what he was doing. He liked the fact that it's a bit anti-establishment and, you know, he's not supposed to. It's like two fingers up to the establishment. But also, he was very knowledgeable and caring about, you know, the animals that he was catching. And so, yeah, we kind of came to the end of our little tour of the woodland and we were walking back towards the village and we stopped at this little copse right on the edge of the lane. And it was in this little kind of dark dip, not too far from some houses. It must have been about 1 a.m. at this point. And he said, oh, there's like always loads of birds that roost in the trees up here. And I was looking around and I couldn't really see anything. Didn't have my contacts in or glasses on and it was pitch black. And he just had this little flashlight and the gun. And he was like, oh, you wait here. I'm going to go in there and see if I can, you know, get a pheasant. And he gave me, so he carries this old post bag, which he uses to put pheasants and rabbits in. He must have had it in the family, I think he said, for about 40-odd years. He got it off of the old postman that used to do the rounds in the village. He gave it to his dad, and then his dad gave it to him. You can fit about 16-odd pheasants in it, I think. So he gave me this tattered old bag, and he was like, you hold that, I'm going to go and try and get a bird. If I get it, just pick it up and chuck it in the bag, and then, you know, we'll leg it back to the village. So I was just stood in the middle of this lane with this bag, and he went off. And I don't know how he managed it. It was just like proper sharpshooter, because he just had this little flashlight and he just shone it up in the tops of the trees, which must have been about, I don't know, 15 metres, maybe 20 metres high. And yeah, shone the light up in the tree and he just took a bird out with one shot. It like dropped from the tree, landed in like the bushes a little way from me, and he was like, quick, like grab it. It was fluttering around, obviously all its nerve endings still going. I ran over and like just grabbed hold of it. It was pretty grim, like chucked it in the bag, and then we both, you know, legged it back along back along the lane back to the village like a couple of outlaws. It was, yeah, I probably got the adrenaline going, and of course, like, because the gunshot was quite loud as well, so you know you can't really hang around. He was saying, like, whenever he shoots a bird like that, he'll always, you know, he'll head off in different directions each time he does it, you know, so that there's less chance of him getting caught. Not that I don't really think that there's anyone that will bother chasing him these days.
From a very early age, you come in contact with the establishment, which is set up round lords, dukes, earls, around that section of society. More so years ago, when they had a big shout in the villages. So from a very early age, 4 or 5 years old, you come in contact with the police and landowners, angry farmers. It's great fun in having them.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Over.
There's so many different routes we could go down now. But I think it's maybe important to talk about, you know, do you not worry, or can you explain why you don't, maybe, about exposing him, you know, in terms of criminal activity, things like that?
Well, there's quite a reasonable explanation for that, which is there's already a book about him and his family, and that goes into detail about his past and the sort of criminal activity, which doesn't, it's not just about poaching, you know, there's other stuff that he's got up to, which, you know, I don't want to romanticize it. I suppose that's the key thing. It's not that I need to worry about exposing him because people already know what he does. It's more a case of not romanticizing it beyond what's sensible. So I think that there is a certain romance around it because of the way that he lives off the land and his understanding of nature in the UK, and from a quite a unique perspective as well. It kind of provokes a lot of questions around, you know, land ownership and access to land. But yeah, then at the same time, it's not that I want to endorse, you know, illegal behaviour, illegal activities. If we were all running around the woods at night with shotguns, then, you know, that can't happen. It wouldn't happen in the UK.
And what are the key points that you think matter, you know, in the context of this Albion project and in the context of British environmentalism and wilderness? Why is Brian's story relevant?
Good question. Brian's story is relevant because we don't really, as a society, I don't think that we understand exactly what's going on our own doorstep when it comes to the environment, the natural environment. So we look at our national parks and our countryside as, you know, our green and pleasant land. And the reality of it is actually very different. Every single inch of the UK has been cultivated and managed for centuries for the benefit of humans. And, you know, that's not going to change. But our connection to the land and living off the land, and therefore valuing healthy ecosystems and valuing nature, what, you know, wildlife, ecology, that all is disappearing, I think, because of the fact that we look at a heavily degraded landscape and we consider it to be beautiful and, you know, wild nature, and it's not. Brian's story is relevant because, like I said before, he lives and breathes the countryside. He lives off the land. He could be entirely self-sufficient if he wanted to be. He understands how to go out and track animals and hunt them for food, and as well as prepare them for food. And he knows how to work the land. He has an allotment. He can grow his vegetables, and he has wood-fired central heating. He doesn't pay for logs from, he'll go out into the woods himself and, take wood to fire his central heating in the house and the hot water. And I think that his story paints a picture about how far removed we are really from nature. And we all watch a lot of wildlife documentaries. We, as a nation, we donate a lot of money to environmental charities and environmental movements, things like deforestation or protecting endangered species overseas, but we don't really pay much attention to what's happened on our own doorstep. And I'm not sure that we're that fussed about it either as a, as a society. It's kind of, this is going to sound quite bleak, but we have a choice about what kind of world we live in the future, whether we realise it or not. So, climate change, I think, is inevitable. And it's not a case of whether humans survive or, we're going to. We have the technology, we are clever enough that we will, survive whatever climate change throws at us. How many of us, and, is another question. But, humans will keep going, the world will keep on spinning. The actual issue, I think, is what will survive with us. And I think it won't be a lot. That we've chipped away so much at wildlife and, natural habitats, that if there are huge temperature shifts in the future, that, certain species, are what remains of our wildlife, won't be able to migrate because we're in their way. Therefore, they'll perish and we'll survive. And it will be like the ultimate age of the human. But that's a choice, right? That doesn't have to happen if we value and understand what's going on, like right now, and we make choices to regenerate our land and protect, not just protect what's left, but also restore and regenerate. And that's where rewilding comes in, regenerating the land, recognizing that the land that Brian is, recognizing the land that the poacher is living off, is also impoverished and degraded. And he can, his understanding can help to, make a positive change, have like a positive impact on how we look after that land in the future. Because we can either end up living in a world which is very industrial, mechanical, the focus is on consumption and profit and progress, where, biotech and AI kind of reign supreme, or we could choose to live in a world which has a plethora of different species, is green and vibrant and has healthy ecosystems, clean water, clean air, and is full of life and variety. And that, that is a choice that we have. And I suppose by looking at stories around our kind of rural history and heritage and nature right on our doorstep, hopefully help to provoke questions around these kind of bigger themes, because it's something that's ultimately relatable to the people, who live in the quintessential rural communities of the UK. It's probably a very long-winded way of answering the question.
No, it's great. I think that, the more of these conversations I have in whichever context and capacity with whoever, the more it becomes blindingly obvious that the issue actually is blinkers. And, everybody's walking around with their blinkers on. And people like Brian offer an opportunity for us to look at a world that we don't know and don't understand, even if it's only 200 metres away from our front door.
Yeah.
you know, to what extent do you think that Brian represents the death of like authentic rural community and like connectedness to nature?
I think he entirely encompasses how we've almost been driven off the land without realizing it. So the author Mark Cocker, in his book Our Place, which is incredible, if you haven't read it, I recommend it, about the sort of history of conservation and in the UK, he describes us as a nation of landless people. So there's so many reasons, but you know, right from things like the Highland clearances and, you know, the Industrial Revolution, you know, the privatization of land, all of this kind of chipping away at our countryside and our access to it has kind of led us to the point where we now are mostly like an urban society. I'm talking, you know, like specifically about the UK. Most of us live in towns, cities, and we essentially all have very small gardens or a backyard. Like, there's not that many of us that own huge swathes of land. There's the kind of preserve for the wealthy, you know, either, you know, farmers, people working the land for profit, whether it's like, you know, the church, the Ministry of Defence, or farming or big shooting estates. You know, we have the highest concentration of land ownership anywhere in the world, second only to Brazil. I think if you take Scotland on its own, that has the highest concentration of private land ownership anywhere in the world. And to that end, it means that most of us are entirely removed from it. And the only way that you can really live in rural communities is either if you're, you know, a farmer, or you earn a lot of money and can afford to live in a nice property, you know, private housing in a nice little pretty village. And, you know, it's very hard to make a living off the land, which is the point that our poacher friend makes in the film, that lots of people move out of these rural communities because A, there's no jobs, and B, it's, you know, it's hard to make a living off the land. And so over centuries, we've been more and more removed from living off the land. We don't really get where our food comes from, whether or not you agree with eating meat. You know, but that it's most of the meat that we do eat is shrink wrapped, and, you know, it's mass produced and, you know, packaged up, and you go into the supermarket and you pick it up off the well lit shelf with all of its pretty packaging, and you have no understanding of just how that got there. And again, that's another reason why that's another loss of connection to the land. And when you look at Brian, he still has that kind of raw connection. He doesn't need the infrastructure that modern society has built up around him to survive. He can, you know, it might be a fairly grim existence by today's standards, but he can get by just fine on his own without too much input from the system.
That's what I was going to say. I think, like, you know, I don't want to get bogged down too much in the weeds of the detailed ethical dilemma of all of this, but there's no way we can go back to living, you know, not everybody wants to live in the way that Brian does, because we've been exposed to Sky TV, Alton Towers, and international travel. And whether you go to, you know, Ibiza or Verbier on your holiday, we want to go on holiday, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the film project that you've been developing for 4 years, you look at all of those people, all of their opinions, Paul Lister and rewilding in Scotland, James Rebanks and the loss of cultural heritage and sheep farming in the UK. What is, in your opinion, the solution to the problem? What is the finale of the film, the last 2 minutes?
It's a big question. the finale of the film for me is that rewilding is not a controversial topic. Rewilding is a positive solution to climate change and protecting nature for the benefit of all of us, not just for an abstraction of wildlife or wilderness, but for humans as well. We are absolutely reliant on clean water, clean air, you know, a healthy ecology to, for our survival. And rewilding isn't the answer, or part of the answer, to mitigating climate change and to ensuring our survival as a species. I mean, you know, it seems to me to be fairly common sense when you kind of look at it all. Obviously, I've done like a lot of reading and listening over the course of 4 years, but like I said, we have a choice, and if we choose to restore and regenerate the UK in terms of nature, then ultimately I think it will make for a much healthier, happier future for everybody. You know, you look at things like nature deficit disorder, which is essentially people who don't have access to natural spaces, who can't just head out for a walk, you know, if, even just in a park or in the woodland. You know, there's higher levels of anxiety and stress in people who never have that kind of interaction or almost like physical space to breathe and switch off and, you know, have some perspective, whether that's through, yeah, tree climbing or just riding your bike through the woods. And, you know, that's an absolute necessity for physical health and mental health. And if we keep on the trajectory that we're going on now, which is, you know, chipping away at our last traces of, you know, old growth woodland in the UK, and, you know, the development of things like HS2, like the chipping away of our green belts through housing development, all of this stuff, you know, we're going to end up in quite a sort of sorry state of affairs. There'll be no balance. It will be a kind of sad monoculture of, you know, farmland and urban environments.
And that's the issue with shifting baseline syndrome, which is, you know, what you introduced me 2 years ago, and how I used to look at the Lake District, and I moved there when I was 16 years old from my urban environment, and I still think it's beautiful, but for different reasons than I used to. And now I, through you and the reading that I've done since, have a better understanding of what it used to be,
yeah,
and maybe what it could be again. But we just think that it's the way it's always been because that's how we know it. And it'll be worse for, you know, the next generation and the generation after, until, you know, we look at elephants and giraffes in the way that we look at dinosaurs.
Yeah, I don't think that that's such a out there statement. I think that we're headed that way now. You know, I interviewed Peter Taylor, who was almost like the grandfather of rewilding in the UK. You know, forget Monbiot, Peter Taylor was there at there at the dawn of time. He almost is a dinosaur. But he opened my eyes to the fact that, you know, we will survive, we'll carry on as, like, humans as a species, but there'll be very little that survives with us unless we embrace things like rewilding.
And so, you know, I'm always keen, I think it's worth saying that, you know, you and I have these conversations all the time.
Yeah.
And over the years, we've learned that we have to put a positive spin on them, otherwise we'll go insane.
Yeah.
So, to put a positive spin on it.
Yeah.
Where do people start with their own journey into understanding rewilding or positive progress towards, you know, changing the spaces that they live, or changing the UK, or changing other parts of the world? I think it would be quite nice, I'm sure you won't mind writing it up, like, you know, 5 books to start with, some short films to watch, things like that, that we can put in podcast show notes. But if you were to recommend one book to start down the path, what would it be?
It's hard, isn't it? Because I think, okay, so there's a few, because I think obviously it depends on your age and the audience. So the first book that I'd recommend, this is probably for people who are already kind of bought into the idea, is called The Abstract Wild by Jack Turner. And it's a series of essays. He's an American author. He's a, you know, a mountain guide based in the States. He did a lot of travelling in the sort of 60s and 70s, and he's a practicing Buddhist, and he's written this series of essays which talks about what we've lost in terms of the wild and why it matters. And he talks quite a lot about how we've turned, how our perception of things like recreation and zoos and all of these kind of attractions are, it's not wilderness, essentially. We've turned the world into this sort of like theme park. But his writing is so beautiful and poignant that it's, I think one of the testimonials on the book is, you know, it's like a cry in the dark. And it kind of, everything sort of unravels when you read it. You know, you can read each of the chapters as a standalone, you know, they're all kind of standalone stories. But they're all sort of saying that, it's a bit bleak, I suppose. It's not a particularly positive outlook. But I think that's important because it does kind of shock you into the realisation that we have to make some kind of positive change. Otherwise, you know, the thought of just living with just humans and domestic dogs and cats for the rest of time is quite a sad world to be living in. And his, you know, his description of travelling, you know, in some fairly remote areas in the States and in the Himalayas in the sort of 60s and 70s is quite wonderful to read as well, you know, exploring all of those in-between places that no one had ever really been to before, and, you know, his experiences there with the communities and wildlife. It's, yeah, it's stunning. The Lost Words is a book by Robert McFarlane, also illustrated by Jackie Morris, and he touts it as a spell book for kids. And the whole premise of this book is the fact that nature words are being removed from the junior dictionary and replaced with words around technology. So, for example, things like acorn and otter and willow, would you believe, have been sort of taken out of the junior dictionary and replaced with things like hashtag and selfie. And that whole thing just kind of encapsulates the journey that we're on at the moment, you know, what, how we kind of prioritize things, and the things that we're essentially forgetting. And, you know, so this book is aimed at kids to kind of tell the story of these nature words that are being lost and what they're kind of referring to. So helping children to, you know, identify different animals and different plants, and just in a really beautiful, poetic and visually engaging way. And, you know, there's lots of people who already know about this book because it's, you know, it's stunning. And there's been a lot in the press around how just almost, I'm fairly incredulous that, you know, a lot of children, you know, they don't know what an acorn is, or they don't know, they can't identify an otter or a heron. You know, that's, yeah. I mean, that kind of thing is, I don't know, just, there's an urgency around sorting this shit out.
Well, yeah, I think there is. And that, and I force myself, which I don't find very difficult anymore, into a positive headspace with it. And you know, we always have a choice with stuff like this where we can either wallow and whinge or we can act.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there's actually, it's a super easy call to arms to say, if you have children, teach them what a willow is, teach them what an acorn is. You know, every positive action like that is a counter to a negative action, is a counter to, you know, kids and their mental health issues because of Snapchat, etc. And so we can all make little positive changes.
Yeah.
And it's the cheesy cliche of, you know, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of that simple.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, taking your kids out to a beach clean, you know, just taking, getting your kids out the weekend, you know, into the countryside, and just, I think it's really important to allow kids to just kind of play and mess around outside, like I did with my mate growing up, just not trying necessarily to force information or learning. Let them go out and explore and figure things out for themselves and, you know, appreciate what they're surrounded by. You know, and there's so many amazing initiatives now dotted around the UK. So our friends Kane and Heather, who run Wild Intrigue, based up in Northumberland, you know, that's an environmental initiative which is aimed at, you know, educating young people about nature, like residentials as well, taking them over to like the Western Isles of Scotland to do nature studies, and they do bat watching evenings with you know, where they'll have like wood-fired pizza and they get everyone around to, you know, with the kids to do the bat counting. And there's just loads of different amazing ways to get involved with, you know, these sorts of initiatives, and that, you know, they're fairly accessible. You know, you only have to do a little Google search on your local area to find little forestry schools or you know, volunteering that you can go and do. It's hard, isn't it? You know, you have to want to go and do it. You know, you have to make it a priority over watching a football match on a Saturday afternoon or but I think that's why it's important to tell these stories and make these films and do it in a way that is accessible to mainstream society.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, people outside of the echo chamber. It's kind of capturing the imagination, isn't it? And doing it in a way that people can sort of like empathize and understand. Yeah.
And we're talking about this, you know, as the lockdown restrictions are easing in the middle of the COVID crisis. And it's a mixed bag because the you know, the negative is that people are leaving rubbish at the door, etc. That's education, you know, that's fixable. But I take huge positives out of the fact that everybody wants to go outside. Yeah, Durdle Door's absolutely rammed. We both live in the Peak District and we can't get out at the weekends anymore. You know, that's a positive. People want to be in the natural world. We just need to, as a society, learn how to do that better.
Yeah, I think so. And it's pressure on these areas. You know, people, because we've lost so much of these kind of wild green spaces, people who are living in these urban environments have to travel so far to get to somewhere where they can enjoy, you know, the fresh air, and it's unusual for them. It's not something that they do, you know, every weekend or every other day. And so I think part of rewilding, the positive of it, is not just about regenerating small areas. We're talking about like huge areas of land that can be restored and regenerated, and creating beauty spots which are closer to the towns and the cities, you know, making more of the green belt so that people can access them a lot more easily, you know, jump on a train and just, you know, be half an hour away from being able to go out and have a picnic and a barbecue in a safe and responsible way somewhere beautiful, without having, you know, everybody kind of this mass exodus from an inner city area to, you know, a beach or a national park. So if we can create more green spaces throughout the UK, it kind of hopefully would potentially ease the pressure on the beauty spots, you know, like those honeypot areas, whether that's, you know, Snowdon or the Hope Valley in the Peak District or Glencoe. You know, if we can get out and enjoy the countryside on our own doorstep a lot more, then, you know, that would hopefully, A, it would make mean that people are kind of doing that more regularly and therefore, you know, more understanding of how to look after these places. Yeah, and B, it would take the pressure off of the honeypots and allow them a bit of, you know, space to be regenerated and looked after and, you know, not so kind of intensively trammelled upon.
Yeah, and, you know, final thing I'll say from that is part of that is enjoying elements of our cultural heritage and looking at, you know, it can be fun to walk down the canal side, you know, on a towpath. We talked just before we pressed record about Edgelands in the UK and how we both really like them as areas, you know, these post-industrial landscapes or the bits of wilderness in heavily inverted commas between towns, between cities, between villages. There's lots of them and there's lots to explore.
Yeah, I mean, we have such a rich tapestry of cultural heritage and sort of rural history, you know, that all kind of sits alongside each other, and it's, you know, it's fascinating. I think especially as a young person to be able to go and explore all these like tumble down buildings along a canal, or, you know, in the farmland there's an old barn to go and, you know, go and explore, or here in the Peak District we've got all of the little like caves and old bits of mines and stuff that just, I don't know, it's a bit, you know, a bit of history. It's kind of exciting and it helps to feed that curiosity. So the cultural heritage side of things and, you know, the farming, and it all has a part to play. There's no getting away from that. You know, it's as much a part of the British landscape as the woodland and the rivers and the natural elements. You know, it has been for, you know, millennia. But there's a way of it all kind of coexisting in balance, I think. So the more that people get out and understand the differences between what a natural landscape looks like and what, you know, a managed landscape looks like, and then I think the more people are engaging that, the better. And it's not saying that, you know, farming is bad, like, you know, intensive farming is bad, but farming that, you know, is balanced with nature and done in a, you know, environmentally sensitive and sustainable way, you know, is good, and that's what we should be kind of aiming towards.
Yeah, and it does exist. It just doesn't exist everywhere.
No.
And that's it, and, you know, slate quarries can be and are beautiful.
Yeah.
Maybe what we need to be thinking about is taking down the 10-foot fences, because some of us, not you or I, obviously, but are climbing over them anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I think letting, again, kids, young people just go out and play outdoors, I feel like, you know, that should be compulsory. You know, yeah, our education is, you know, it's so systemic and so blinkered. We only learn certain things in certain ways, and it's, you know, I feel like it teaches us what to think, not how to think. And if we had a bit more of an approach like around environmental education of how to think rather than, you know, this is bad, this is good, then it would serve us, you know, humans, all species, a lot better. If we can make up our own minds about things, come to our own conclusions. Because that's what happened to me, you know, through, almost by accident in a way, but just through one little like film that I watched and then a book that I read, and all of a sudden everything that I thought I knew about the UK countryside just unraveled, and actually the reality was very different. But no one had ever told me that.
No, and it's about creating momentum. I mean, again, just look at what Extinction Rebellion are doing. Look at the Black Lives Matter movement, which, you know, gained traction in the last 2 weeks. It's about creating a movement which is obviously driven by people, masses of people.
Yeah.
And I think once one starts educating people and you realise that most of the land that you are walking through and running through is used to breed grouse so that rich people can shoot them, you start to want to tear that infrastructure down, mm-hmm. metaphorically.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Positivity. Vive la revolution.
I've had some fairly, you know, fairly intense arguments with friends about all this sort of stuff, you know, and it's, I think it's just, I think a lot of people's connection to nature and wildlife is quite emotional. You know, it comes from things that they've, it's like a belief almost. They might not live and breathe it every day like the poacher does. You know, they're not working the land, they're not getting their hands dirty, they haven't got soil under their fingertips and, you know, out in the elements every day. But for some reason, this, you know, the green and pleasant land of the UK is like an institution, and it's like almost like this religious thing that you cannot say anything bad about it, and, you know, it's ours and it's beautiful and quintessential England is just like the best thing since sliced bread. And so to try and change that perspective to say, actually, it's not, it could be better, you know, we need to love it more, we need to do more for it to help it like regenerate, because actually it's degraded. And those moorlands that you love so much, like on your run or your bike ride, are actually like an intensive grouse moor that have just, you know, eradicated most other species that could exist there. You know, that's a big thing to for someone to, you know, to process. And so, yeah, I've had a fair few heated debates with friends. But I keep at it.
Well, bring it on. Let's have the debates. I think that's the point, right? As long as they're calm and they're civil and both parties are willing to listen,
yeah.
which is something that we don't have a lot of left in modern society.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we need. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about dry stone walls. Let's talk about sheep farming. That doesn't mean we can't change our minds.
No, absolutely. Yeah, it's, you know, it's, I was talking to a friend of ours who's, you know, an exec producer down in London about, you know, trying to get funding for this documentary film. And, you know, his point was like, oh, you know, it's not sexy. It's not, you know, where's the conflict? Where's the peril? You know, people aren't going to watch it or pay attention if there isn't, you know, this kind of almost sensationalized story or like a hook that's going to be controversial. And I guess that's the sad reality, is that it's, you know, it shouldn't be controversial. It's, there should be balance, there should be, you know, integrity, and you know, that, yeah, potentially that doesn't sell newspapers, doesn't necessarily sell films, you know, but doesn't mean that it's not important.
Yeah.
And it's definitely, you know, it's definitely the way forward, I think.
It will, once the sea levels rise and we run out of places to hang out.
Yeah.
Once we close off Dirtle Door, once we, you know, get rid of the sheep farming because it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Oh, it's fascinating, isn't it? I would love to. So I basically come from the outdoor community. That's sort of my identity, if you like, where all, you know, I spend most of my time hanging out with climbers, runners, you know, cyclists, people who are into kind of outdoor recreation. And I would love to know what the consensus would be. So take, for example, Stanage Edge, which is like, it's basically where all rock climbers in the UK, like, they'll all make a pilgrimage to Stanage to go climbing. It's sort of like the epicentre of climbing in England. If we decided that we were going to close access to Stanage for 10 years because it's like hugely eroded, all of the nesting birds that, you know, can potentially nest there and do nest there are under threat, you know, the ring ousels which nest there now aren't coming back because there's too many people, there's too much litter, you know, the ground's eroded, we're going to shut it for 10 years to allow it to regenerate, to take the pressure off it, to allow other species that use that area to thrive and exist without disturbance. What would the climbing community or the outdoor community say about that? Would we say, okay, you know what? Yeah, 10 years, that's fine. Let's preserve it for future generations and for species other than humans. You know, would we sacrifice that for the sake of future generations and for the sake of other species? Or would we say, no, I want to go climbing. This is like absolutely, it's my God-given right to be able to go up to Stanage and tie on and go and like climb some routes. That's, you know, that's my priority. That's, I would love to.
But it's interesting, you know, I'm a rock climber who lives, you know, if we look out this window and there wasn't a building in the way, we could see Stanage.
Mm-hmm.
I live a mile and a half-ish from Stanage Edge. I would say, yeah, sure, let's shut it down for 10 years. As long as I can still go and climb everywhere else, but what about the erosion that's going to be caused at Millstone instead because everyone goes there?
Mm.
Yeah, that's the issue.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, let's not get into this now, but it's like Allerdale Wilderness Estate in Scotland. You're not allowed to go and walk around in it. It's privately owned.
Mm.
And the really interesting conversation for a different day is, you know, is the way forward benevolent dictatorship of land ownership?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, let's say, you know, near enough, near as damn it, the whole of Scotland is privately owned by rich lairds and landowners.
Mm-hmm.
If 90% of them decided to rewild, that would be a good thing, right?
Yeah.
It's still land ownership, but it fits our agenda.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, like, access, I suppose, is another subject altogether in terms of no matter what you're doing to that land, maybe with the exception of, you know, like food production and, you know, we should be able to access it. If you're regenerating something like, you know, tree planting, whatever, you can access it in certain ways, but, you know, potentially entrusting people to stick to footpaths and, you know, rather than being able to like run off piste and wherever you like. I suppose the thing is, it's trying to get people to sacrifice their own, yeah, sacrifice their own just sort of things that they love doing for the sake of other species and other generations, future generations. It's such a complex subject.
Yeah, I think, like, we'll kind of leave it there. And I've said this already, but my last point, I think if people were to go and watch How Wolves Change Rivers by George Monbiot, you know, tell me we shouldn't be doing that in the UK. You know, I'm up for the debate, but
yeah,
tell me we shouldn't. Because that is 10 minutes of Monbiot at his best, you know, explaining exactly why wolves do change rivers and why we should have large predators in Scotland.
Yeah. Yeah. And why we don't have them anymore. Because they used to be here. It wasn't that long ago that, in the broad scheme of things, and the reason that they're not here anymore is because of us. We could put them back if we really wanted to. It's just a choice.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft and produced and distributed by Pip Saunders and Alex Hall. The podcast is also produced in association with Sidetrack Magazine, an outstanding publication that features incredible stories of adventure. You can find more at sidetrack.com. If you enjoy the podcast, then please do tell your friends, and also please take 10 seconds to leave us a review on iTunes. They make the world of difference to us. Thanks very much, and see you next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.